We're coming near the end of our series on the life of David, a series about leadership and about holiness and all kinds of terrific lessons that we can learn from King David in 1 and 2 Samuel. As I was preparing for this message, I was intrigued to read in our Star Ledger. In fact, I haven't actually read the whole thing. I've just glanced at parts of it, but some of you, I'm sure, have seen the cover story in the Ledger. The forbidden emails about involving our governor, former governor, and his mistress. And many of you know that John Corzine is a former CEO and chairman of Goldman Sachs, a global investment firm, one of the most powerful and influential companies in the United States, and then the governor of New Jersey. And it was sad and sordid to read even the portions that I did read of these, of all of his email transcripts. I think they're mostly text messages and emails between him and his mistress. And I don't really know how they got in the Star Ledger, but they did. And so it was very sort of discouraging to see some of that correspondence going between our governor and his mistress. And then, which a little over a week ago, I believe, that the CEO of Hewlett-Packard was asked to resign by the board. He was a person who had been enormously effective as the leader of Hewlett-Packard. Under his leadership, stockholders were very happy, and revenues grew, and he seemed to do a great job. I haven't actually figured out exactly what he did wrong. I know that he seemed to pad his expense account by saying that he was having luncheons with some people when she was there, and apparently the other people weren't. But in any case, he did admit that he had been doing things that he knew he should not have done with finances related to payments to that woman. And then, thirdly, recently I was reading about Mel Gibson. It came in the context of an article on a website called Belief.com, which is a Christian website. And they have lots of sort of feature stories about what God is doing and what's going on with Christians around the world. And there's a recent story about another actor that someone told me about. But that article refers to a list on BeliefNet's website. And the list has the 12 most powerful Christians in Hollywood. And at the time when the article was written that I was reading this week, it said that the number one person in terms of the 12 most powerful Christians in Hollywood was Mel Gibson. And of course, Mel Gibson's a person who was married for 26 years to his wife and has quite a few children by them. And in recent times, he's divorced her and he's been cavorting about with another woman who apparently sang on his record label. And the alcohol problems that he's had since his younger years have resurfaced with a vengeance. And so you go from the realm of politics to the realm of business to the realm of entertainment. And what we're seeing in our culture right now is middle-aged men at the peak of their careers, careening off into self-destructive moral folly. How do we understand this? What was going on with them? And how can we learn lessons? Because certainly in the case of Mel Gibson, he claimed to be some kind of Christian. The best place in all the Bible to understand something about what was going on with these three men is to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11. This story teaches us very vividly three lessons. Three quick lessons and then three applications. First of all, we see that lust leads to other abuses. I think that almost anyone who's honest can find something of himself in this passage that we've just read. Certainly, it's primarily about David and Bathsheba and what happens to Bathsheba's husband as a result of David's sin. And also, it leads to the next chapter that speaks of Nathan and how God used Nathan to begin to set things back in some semblance of order. But as we look at this, we see not only the lust of David from when he saw a beautiful, unclothed woman from the roof of his palace, but we see the way that his lust led to other abuses. This story is about lust overwhelming restraint and issuing in a gross abuse of power. Any one of us who has leadership responsibilities, whether as a parent or a grandparent, It may be with people at work, and it may be with people at church. For many of you in this room have a certain power that you exercise, a certain leadership that you exercise over other people. David is a classic example of what happens when leaders forget that they're ultimately accountable to God. Eugene Peterson is a scholar in Vancouver, British Columbia, and his insight into this passage has been very helpful to me this week. He traces the decline of David in this chapter in seven steps of wandering away from a true understanding of what it meant to be the king, to serve God and to serve people. And each one of these steps involves the use of a verb, sent, or sent. Follow along as I follow Peterson and walk you through this story. This passage begins with a curt phrase, David sent Joab. Verse 1 is the spring, when the time when the kings go off to war, and David sent his general out to war. There's actually nothing wrong with this. David was king and Joab was his general, and it was a legitimate use of his authority to send Joab out to fight. He told him to go, and he went. So far, nothing wrong. But two verses later, what do we find in verse 3? David sent to inquire about Bathsheba. Now here again, we have a king issuing orders to one of his servants. But in this case, it's not really in David's line of work to find out about the naked women that he sees from the palace roof. So, and it's what we already see here, a bit of the lust springing up and beginning to color the way David uses the authority that he has. By the time the word occurs in verse 4, this is now the third step, we see sending that's kind of neutral, the sending of Joab. Then we see ascending to learn about Bathsheba, and there's a little bit of a line crossed there. And then thirdly, David sends the messenger to get Bathsheba, and he sends for her in order to take her to bed with him. And now we know that something has changed. We don't find any more that David is using the legitimate power that he has as king to govern the people, to be concerned for their welfare, and to be aware that his leadership is a stewardship. He acknowledged in 2 Samuel 5, he knew that God had made him king, and he knew why. 2 Samuel 5:12. David realized that God had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom. Why? For the sake of his people, Israel. God had made David king because God wanted to use David to bless the nation. And that's certainly not in David's mind here, how he can bless Uriah and Bathsheba as he brings his warrior's wife to his bed. Power notoriously corrupts, and it's right at this point that we see that David's corruption has begun. Then the fourth step is in verse 6. We see the corruption just increasing and blooming in David's life. There are three sendings in verse 6. Follow as I read. So David sent this word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. Here the point is that there's a ruthless use of bare power. There's no sense of morality or responsibility or personal relationship. If we knew nothing else about Uriah than the fact that he was the husband of Bathsheba, it would be bad enough. But what we know about Uriah, that he was one of David's mighty men. He was one of the people described in 2 Chronicles as those people who were extremely gifted warriors who were loyal personally to David, and they were known as the mighty men. There were 30 mighty men, and there were three who were outside the 30 who were over the mighty men. But those 33 men had said, we're warriors. We have been blessed with enormous physical prowess and ability in battle, and we are going to dedicate ourselves to you, our king. They had taken their enormous gifts and said, David, we want these gifts to serve you. And Uriah was one of that 33. And so, when David is sending to his general, and the general sends Uriah back, what we see is not only abuse of power, but abuse of relationship. And we're going to say a lot more about that in a few minutes. David is at this point intoxicated by his sin. He's already slept with a woman. He knows that he has power. He knows that he can have Joab send Uriah to him. And adrenaline is coursing in his veins. He's very conscious that he can do what he wants. and he's telling Joab to have Uriah killed in battle. That's actually the fifth and next stage. What we see is ascending. When Uriah proves to be a very noble person, when David tells him, go home and wash your feet, that's a sexual idiom in Hebrew that means to have sexual relations. And we can tell that because Uriah responds, how could I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife? And he doesn't do it because he's loyal to the army that's out in the field. For David to have a man like this, so dedicated to the kingdom, so dedicated to the other soldiers who are out at war, I'm not going to go and relax and please myself while the army is out in the field. And when David sends this righteous, loyal soldier back, he's sending him with his own death warrant. The letter instructs Joab, the general, to have the man killed. So David's power is vividly displayed in this fifth step. But then all of a sudden there's a turning. In the sixth step of sending, we see that David is not quite as in control as he thought. Two things happen. Despite his seemingly successful venture into the exercise of depersonalized royal power, two things happen in 5 and verse 18. First, Bathsheba sends word to David, I'm pregnant. The fertile, healthy womb of the young Bathsheba was not under David's control. He could sleep and he could try to cover up the pregnancy, but that womb, being fertile, conceived a child. And then in verse 18, Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting. And as you read carefully what Joab says, you can tell that Joab, who's kind of a scheming general, he knows exactly what David is doing. Joab is fully informed and aware. And those two things are going to come back to haunt David. First, the pregnancy, and second, the fact that Joab knows. And then finally, we don't see it actually unless you've got your Bibles. That's why I constantly encourage you to bring them, because 2 Samuel 12 begins with a verse, 12:1 says, that the Lord sent Nathan to David. See, David is abusing his power and sinning wildly in 2 Samuel 11. And what we see in 12:1 is that there's a sovereign, holy God who sees the whole thing. We need to be reminded, as David was about to be reminded in 2 Samuel 12, that there is a sovereign, holy God who sees everything that happens in this world. But the seven steps of descent into abuse, six steps of descent by David, and then the seventh step in which God makes his wisdom and his holiness known. And the story ends bleakly with the last sentence in verse chapter 11, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord. First of all, then, lust leads to other abuses. And secondly, loving God teaches me to live for the reason He made me. Loving God teaches me to live for the reason He made me. One of the reasons that it's so depressing when we read this story is that it's a story about David. David is known in all the Bible as the man after God's own heart, the sweet singer of Israel. Many of the Psalms were... David was one of the authors of the Bible. And it is a man who knew God who descended to this. Scholars point out that there's actually, between the lives of Goliath and Bathsheba, we see two moments of particular testing for David. Goliath and Bathsheba are radically different people. One is a tall, just hulking giant, massive in power. And the other is a young and beautiful woman. When David encounters each of these people, he's at a different stage in his life. On the one hand, when he meets Goliath, he's young. Saul, speaking to him in a friendly way, says, you shouldn't go out to fight Goliath. You're only a boy. David was probably 12, 13, 14 when he killed Goliath. So he was young when he met Goliath. He was a sure man with wives and sons and king and established in 2 Samuel 11. And there are two radically different outcomes in the two encounters. On the one hand, when he meets Goliath, he immediately starts thinking in terms of God. Who is this? uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God. It's a God-centered response to the Philistine enemy. And that God-centered response leads to victory and honor and love. But on the other hand, when he encounters Bathsheba, the young and beautiful woman, it ends, there's no mention of David speaking to God or thinking in terms of God in all of 2 Samuel 11. David is continually turning to God. David is remarkable because he's a person who inquires of the Lord continually. Not in 2 Samuel 11. There's an absence of God in David's mind. And it leads him, in this moment of testing, to defeat, shame, being despised and mocked by his own people. So there are two different people, Goliath and Bathsheba. Two different stages in his life. Two radically different outcomes in his life. But there's one identical, sovereign, holy God over both stories. Knowing that God, if David had been close to God in 2 Samuel 11, as he was in 2 Samuel 5 when he became king, as he was in 1 Samuel 17 when he fought Goliath, or in the many other places that we've seen in the last few weeks, if David had been close to God, this would not have happened. There's a beautiful woman. Thank you, God, that you made feminine beauty. And thank you that I have a wife. In fact, more than one. Which was not God's fault. But in any case, David doesn't mention God and he doesn't love God in this passage. Last week I talked to you about the way that Peter Kreeft, philosophy professor at Boston College, is a person who is, I believe, now in his 70s. But he speaks about how he loves to surf. He's not what he calls a hot dog surfer, riding the really huge waves. But even in his 70s, he can get up on his board and ride the low ones. And he said, surfing is like worship. Surfing teaches you to recognize the power and the wonder of God in the world and to align your life with it, to get up on your board and glide down the wave. When we worship, when we love God, when we acknowledge His hand in our world, we are protected from sinful behaviors. And we are guided away from them into the things that God has called us to do. So first, lust leads us to abuses. And loving God can teach me to live for the reason He made me. Now we're going to take a turn and talk about the way in which sin destroys my capacity to lead. I'd like to now go to the PowerPoint slide on leadership. Some of you know that it's been my privilege in the last few years to meet a man named Olin Jennings. He's a person who's been very successful as a management consultant. He's a believer. And he's a person who, when he consults with business and science leaders, charges for 10 sessions of his time $60,000. He commands a considerable sum, and the people who go to this person for help are people at the very high end of the economic ladder and who have significant training budgets. And so one of the things that I've learned from Olin Jennings is that there are different levels of leadership that one can have in this world. And so let's just walk through them briefly. These, again, come from Olin Jennings. Level one leadership has to do with being in an appointed position. In fact, Olin says the person at level one is really a manager and not a leader at all. A person at level one leads because he has the title, and he often leads by intimidation. I'm the shift clerk. You're the person who puts the groceries on the shelf. You do what I say when I say it because I'm the boss. I'm over you, and you just do it. There's usually under-appointed appointed positional kinds of leaders. In this kind of a job, there's usually high turnover, low morale, difficulty with volunteers. Difficulty with volunteers, white-collar, and younger kinds of people. Because the person leading by position only, he's not given that, he's not exercising talent or his personal gifts. There are various kinds of positional leadership. In fact, you can be a parent and be a positional leader. If you can have children, you have the position of being a parent. But what kind of parent you are, you certainly want to be moving up this ladder. But basic and introductory to say there is a kind of leadership here, but it's very low level. Then the next level is Level two is characterized by relationship. Your followers like you. And here you lead by influencing other people, and they want to follow you. And this is the beginning of true leadership, because you're investing in others, you like, love, and respect them, and they choose to follow you. We're going to look at the way that David exemplified 2, 3, 4, and 5. So this is level two, the beginning of leadership. Then there's three. Up here, you are able to produce results. See, as I go through this, think about this in your work. Think about this if you're a small group leader. How are things going in your small group? If you're a parent or a grandparent, what kind of influence and leadership are you exercising in your family with your grandchildren or children? Your followers admire your ability to perform. You lead by achievement. And as problems come up in the nature of your family or your small group or your company, you're able to solve the problems quickly because there's a momentum that the success that your leadership brings causes a momentum, and people are quick to follow your solutions and the problems are quickly dealt with. You draw people together to accomplish a purpose. Getting higher and higher now, level four. Here you're the kind of leader who reproduces other leaders. The followers who are around you are not, they don't only like you, they're personally loyal to you. They want to be around you. They choose to be with you. And here you lead by empowering, by investing in others personally. You create growth by coaching leaders who pass on what they know. Some of you who have older children, as I do, have perhaps seen the thrill of having an older son or daughter who is able to influence the younger ones toward the Lord. My oldest son was actually able to lead his younger sister to accept the Lord when she was around, I don't know, 3 or 4, and he was somewhere under 10. And recently we're on a family vacation, and my number two son, who's around 19, he said and did things that were wonderful and were a blessing to the family. And so if we are leading in ways that are pleasing to God, there will be the way in which we're going, the kind of leadership we want to have, will be reproduced around us. And then fifthly, and Olin, as he consults around the country and around the world, he says, I always tell people, if you work hard with me, I can get you to number four. But getting up to number five, very few people get to number five. And you get to number five on your own. Number five is all about respect. Your followers are people who deeply respect you as a person. You lead from character. The kind of person that you are day by day is something that draws people to come behind you. And respect derives from all you are and all you represent. Now David, let's think about how David was an example of these things. He's one of the greatest examples of leadership in all of world literature, in all of the history of the world. He bursts onto the scene as a level three leader. When he's a young boy, Saul says, you shouldn't go to fight Goliath. You are only a boy. And so at 12 or 13, with the Israelite army cowering on the side and Goliath mocking them from the field, this young boy goes out, kills Goliath. The army surges up with excitement, pursues the Philistines, and defeats them. And David just emerges as a young teen at level three. But then, as you know, things go badly because Saul becomes jealous. And what happens is that when the women sing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands, what's going on? Again, David's ability to produce results has become the matter of song. And the people of Israel are just delighted that we have this kind of an effective leader. And Saul is offended and jealous, and so David has to be a man on the run. But what happens when he's on the run? When he's on the run, what happens is people who are disaffected, maybe they've lost their job, or there's a problem in the family, or they're fight with their parents, the people begin to come to David, even though he's in hiding and he's hard to find. People begin to come to David from all over Israel. He is very evidently a person who has followers who like him. And he respects and loves and likes them. When he becomes king, it's amazing because David has, we don't really know much about Hiram of Tyre and his relationship with David before David becomes king. And immediately, when he becomes king, Hiram says, I'm going to send you carpenters and laborers and lumber for you to build a palace. And David sends back and says, thank you very much. And then in the passage in 2 Samuel 10 that we looked at last week, the king of the Ammonites died. And David sent men to say, "Oh, I'm so sorry," a delegation to express sympathy to Hanun, king of the Ammonites. Why? Because he was a fellow king. And David built relationships and friendships. David, even though he begins here at level 3, we can see he certainly has the qualities of likability. And then we see him rising and rising into level 4. He naturally drew leaders around him. We talked a few minutes ago about the 30 mighty men and the three who were over the 30. And David drew generals and powerful fighters were drawn to David because he was a man like them who was gifted in that area, and he also had a character that they admired. And so he was certainly level 4. I didn't have a chance to preach about this, but David, there's a story about when he's out in war, and he says, "Oh, that I had some water by the well in Bethlehem." And so some of them might even hear about it. They say, "Our king wants water from the well." And they break through the Philistine lines at the risk of their lives. They get water from the well, and they bring it back. And David, "Here's your water from the well of Bethlehem." And he pours it out before the Lord. He says, "This, I could no more drink this water than I could drink your blood. This is holy water. You men got this water at the risk of your lives. I'm so grateful to you as men. I'm so glad to know you and to have you with me that I would no more drink this water than I don't dare. It's holy water." And that produced a loyalty in them. They became so loyal to him. And then another person I mentioned last week about level 5, the people of Israel after David became king in 2 Samuel 5, it says, everything that the king did pleased the people. What's that? That's level 5. His nation respected him and they loved him and they were glad to be David's subjects. Here's what Olin says. The most important trait in a leader is integrity. The absolute foundational character quality for a leader is trust. Can I trust you? Because if I can't trust you, it really doesn't matter how much I like you, and it really doesn't matter how well you can perform. Because if I can't trust you, then you may lead me in the wrong direction. So Olin says, and it's been sort of a goad in my side to strive for purity. And in Acts 24, Paul says, "I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward God and toward men." Why? Because Paul knew he was a leader. He was the man that God used to extend Christianity throughout the Roman world. Here's the point. When David chose to let his lust overwhelm him, he destroyed the very root of his leadership. If integrity is the most important job of a leader, when you choose to live away from integrity, you're choosing to let all of this fall apart. You understand? David was an amazing leader. But what we see, sadly, is how deeply he fell. Loving God, sin destroys my capacity to lead. Three applications as we prepare to close. First, remember that God is both sovereign and holy. I get some help on this one from Leland Ryken. Leland Ryken is a senior professor at Wheaton College. His son has just left one of the most prestigious pulpits in the nation to become president of Wheaton College. And Leland Ryken, the father, has written a great book. If for any of you who are interested in studying the Bible at a deeper level, I can't resist recommending Words of Delight. This is a book that talks about the way the Bible is great literature. Psalms, Deuteronomy, the Gospels, and how the traits of great literature are found in the Bible and how what we can learn about God by understanding the Bible as literature. Ryken says this, "There are lots of hero stories in world literature, and David is not the only hero in the hero stories of the world who is diverted by sexual relations with a beautiful woman from doing what he was supposed to do." And Ryken points out that in Homer's Odyssey, the hero, Odysseus, has sexual relations with two goddesses. One is Calypso and the other Circe. But in the context of Homer, it doesn't matter that much. And the reason is, both Calypso and Circe are goddesses, and he is coerced and seduced by them into the sex that he has with them. Neither Odysseus nor his wife Penelope cares very much that he's been sexually active with the two goddesses. But in the Bible, what we see at the end of the David story here, the thing David had done displeased the Lord. In the Bible, a holy God is displeased by the sin of adultery. And the point is this. In the Bible's worldview, adultery is horrible because it is a perversion of something that God made in a very particular way to be holy and awesome and beautiful. God designed for the faithful love of a husband and a wife to reflect the relationship that he intends between Jesus Christ and his church. God is presented throughout the Old Testament as the husband of Israel, and he sees her idolatries as adultery. Hosea 3:1, God tells Hosea, go again, love a woman who is beloved of an adulterer, and have relations with her, as the Lord loves the people of Israel, though they turn to other gods. God presents himself as a husband. He presents Christian marriage as something holy and sacred and special. That leads us to the next verse, Leviticus 19:2. Why are Christian marriages, why is it so important that we pursue purity? Because the Lord tells us, be holy. Why? Because I am holy. I am working in your life to prepare you to live with me. Second, lean into fellowship. Second application. As we read 2 Samuel 11, I don't think we can help but feel a certain sense of sadness and tragedy. We can take down the PowerPoint. The tragedy of David's life is that he rose so high, and then through personal weakness and sin, he fell so dramatically. And in 2 Samuel 12, God is going to use Nathan the prophet to say to David, because you did this, the sword will never leave your house. Because of what you did to Uriah, your faithful soldier, you have invited the sword and murder into your house, and it will come. You've invited adultery into your family, and it will come. And we see as the rest of David's life unfolds that those two things are true. What happened? What happened to David there? Something that happens in a less dramatic way to many, many people. I think the reason that I could tell you, and that there are always going to be stories in the newspaper about people like Corzine and the CEO of Hewlett Packard and Mel Gibson, the reason these things are always going to be true is that there are many, many people who get to be middle-aged. And they've spent decades toiling, sacrificing, and denying themselves and investing in their families, their churches, and their companies. And then they hit 45. Or they hit 50. Or 55. And they say, all right, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been obeying the rules. I've been doing the right thing. And now I want fill in the blank. It's usually the same three things. Money, sex, and power. And now, it's time for me. I'm tired of being good. Some people say this, they get to the top of the ladder in their world, as Corzine and the HP CEO and Gibson all were at the peak of their professions. Some of them make it to the top, and they say, I want more. And others of them, and this would be the mass of humanity, wouldn't it? Because how many of us really make it to the very top of our profession? Far more people say, I've been working hard. Tim Keller, pastor of Redeemer in Manhattan, says, you know what pornography is? Pornography is people clawing their way up the rock wall face of the challenges of life and wanting a break. And all you have to do is hit the return key and you have fun and games. And many people say, I've been working hard for years, and what did this get me? I've tried to do things right, but things haven't worked out. I am going to break the rules because it's time for me. This is not 2 Samuel 11 about a young man's sin. It's about an old man's sin. As I was preparing this message, I thought of the many, many people I know, my age and older than myself, who've done the kinds of things that we've read about in this chapter. And the annual statistics on divorce, the age group where there's the most incidence of divorce, shifts around. Sometimes it's people who've been married 7 or 8 years. You probably heard that statistic. But I'll tell you, there have been several years when the demographic where there's the greatest incidence of divorce is people 50 to 55. Empty nesters, the kids are gone, and it's Miller time. I've been working hard, and I want a break. You know, when I think about this, what aspect of the various ways that God works in our lives to bring us to maturity, what aspect would have kept David safe? What would have caused him to end well? I thought, well, maybe reading the Bible. I told you, David wrote the Bible. David knew the Bible very well. He was, most of his life, he was a worshiper. And what I think was missing in 2 Samuel 11 was fellowship. Look at the next verse in your outline. I've misplaced mine, but it says, I believe it says, flee the evil desires of youth and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. And would you please underline, along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. Along with other people who are pursuing the same things you are. What David needed, another thing we could say about sin, if we could spend a lot of time talking about this chapter, but David's falling into sin in 2 Samuel 11, he began having wrong kinds of relationship with women a long time before this. And if he had men who were his friends and he could be transparent and share his heart, he could say, you know, I realize I shouldn't have taken two. And, you know, just pray for me, I won't take three. A third wife. But he didn't seem to, at this level, he didn't seem to have people speaking into his life. But what I've said to you before is that David is a great example, but David is supposed to point us to the greater example of Jesus and to the whole revelation of the New Testament. I know many, many people who are tempted powerfully toward alcohol, toward sexual indiscretion, toward abusive power, and because they are close to other men or other women with whom they can pray and share their hearts and pray for strength, those people's lives change. You can change. You can be different. And here I want to put in a plug for our small groups. The best place at Crossroads to move toward this kind of transparency is in a small group. Rick Warren says, we all need to love and be loved, to know and be known, to serve and be served. I can't take close care of all of you, even though it's my duty to be a pastor. But God's family is here for each other. And it is as we are in those small groups, as we build friendships and we share our lives in the context of other godly men and women, that you are going to grow. Our best small groups have that kind of loving transparency. Third, and finally, love the true King. You can't help but read this story and think, oh, what might have been. Oh, if David had only persisted in obeying God. But that is there for a reason. The Bible shows us both David's enormous strengths and his terrible weaknesses. And it does so because you and I have strengths and weaknesses as well. We have moments of obedience and we have moments of sinfulness. And the Bible teaches us that David, as great as he was, he is not the real answer to our problems. I began with Corzine and the CEO of Hewlett-Packard and Mel Gibson. And the question that the Davids and the Corzines of this world raise for all of us is, where's the real leader? Where's the real role model? who can lead people well and who can lead himself well? And the answer the Bible would give us is, there's only one. There's only one. Some of you have heard the little essay that comes from a pastor. It was written in 1926. One Solitary Life. Here is a man born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. For 3 years, he was a preacher. Never owned a home, never wrote a book, never held an office, never had a family. Never went to college. Never put his foot inside a really big city. Never traveled 200 miles from his home, the place he was born. Never did one of the things that usually accompanies greatness. Lead a great army. Write a great book. He had no credentials but himself. While still a young man, the tide of popular opinion turned against him. His friends ran away. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies. He went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed upon a cross between two thieves. While he was dying, his executioners gambled for the only piece of property he had left on earth, his cloak. When he was dead, he was buried in a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. And here's the best part. This pastor said in 1926, I am far within the bounds. I am far within the bounds when I tell you this about Jesus. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies ever built, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned, none of these have affected the history of this world as much as the life of that one man. And how did Jesus end? We've looked at David and his midlife crisis. Jesus never had a midlife crisis. He was consistently an amazing leader. When he was in this world, we get a taste of it. I've said many times when we go to Ecuador, because in the medical mission, we get to see doctors healing the body and spiritual leaders ministering to the needs of the soul. And what we find is, when we put out the news, hundreds, nay, thousands come. When Jesus walked this earth, he was surrounded by people because they wanted to be led by him. And how did he end? Next verse on your outline. Read it with me. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. And my point there, that's in John 13, he's getting ready to get up from the table and wash their feet. But think of him then on the cross. There he is, nailed to the cross. Son, behold your mother. Mother, behold your son. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. This day to the thief who acknowledged him. This day you will be with me in paradise. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them, another translation says, to the end. Jesus is, as we sang earlier, our prophet, priest, and king. There is no greater leader, there is no greater hero that we can have than this one who loved us so much and who has shaped our world so powerfully.